Tina Liu, A Delicate Game, The Meaning of Law on Grouse Creek. BC Studies, number 96, Winter, 1992-1993. At the end of June in 1862, 100 miners returned from the Caribou boarded the steamer Henrietta and Douglas for the trip to New Westminster. They refused to pay for their passage, claiming that their misadventures in the upper country gold fields had left them starving and broken, as well as broke. Despite the obvious illegality of the miners' actions, Douglas magistrate John Bowles Gagan advised the master of Henrietta to take the men on and on arrival at New Westminster apply to the proper authorities for redress. Gagan took this course of action believing, as he told the colonial secretary, that to attempt coercion with a force unable to command it would have weakened the apparent power of the law, and that the getting of these men out of Douglas was in every way desirable. Any attempt to arrest would have provoked a riot, perhaps bloodshed, and I believe I acted prudently in avoiding the least risk of this. In an effort to further justify his actions, Gagan closed his report on a defiant note with this telling observation. Magistrates in these upcountry towns have a delicate game to play, and I believe we are all of the opinion that to avoid provoking resistance to the law is the manner in which we best serve the interests of His Excellency, the Governor. As it is the matter passed off without riot and without defiance of the magistrate, though the master of the steamer was somewhat annoyed, I shall be very sorry if the cautious way I acted with such quiet results does not meet His Excellency's approval, but I acted for the best. The colonial government chastised the magistrate for his, quote, want of nerve and judgment, close quote, in allowing the occurrence of so lawless a proceeding. It appears, noted Colonial Secretary W.A.G. Young, that you consider yourself vested with discretionary power to temporize with your duties, and that you are unaware that, while rigidly dispensing the laws for the protection of life and property, a magistrate may act with perfect temper and discretion. This brief episode raises questions about the social meaning of the law which I am concerned to address. Gagan considered law to be the preservation of order, quiet results, and told his superiors so. From his vantage point in Victoria, Governor James Douglas saw things rather differently. The law, through its rigid application, served a more particular end by securing life and property. There was yet another perspective. Both Gagan and Douglas considered the miners' actions lawless, but those who boarded Henrietta likely did not feel the same way. Different people attached different meanings to the law, and when they used the courts to resolve their disputes, these differences became apparent. As legal anthropologists argue, courts are forums in which people bargain for reality. Not only do they dispute the facts, what happened, but they also dispute what constitutes legal and just action. From their arrival, British Columbia's miners possessed a reputation as a self-conscious and vocal interest group with a penchant for self-government, which they learned in California's gold fields. Despite their impermanent character, California's gold mining camps developed an elaborate system of informal regulation centered on the miners' meetings. These were elected tribunals of local miners who drafted the rules which governed behavior in a specific locale. Their regulations covered a wide range of activities, from claim size, the technicalities of ditch widths and water rights, to the use of alcohol and firearms in the camps. This experience instilled the miners with a taste for local government and a certain degree of independence. It was this independence that made those who streamed northward to British Columbia in 1858 to try their luck in the Fraser and Caribou rushes so dangerous in the eyes of British colonial administrators like James Douglas and Supreme Court Judge Matthew Bailey Begbie. These men considered the miners a lawless bunch and took steps to prevent local government from gaining a foothold on the banks of the Fraser River. In September 1858, just a month after the mainland colony was formed, James Douglas issued the first Gold Fields Act. It and subsequent acts created and elaborated formal government institutions and regulations specifically designed to regulate gold mining. An assistant gold commissioner presided over locally based gold commissioners or mining courts. He had jurisdiction to hear all mining or mining-related disputes and dispose of them summarily. By doing so, the Gold Commissioner's Court allowed suitors to avoid the costly delays associated with Supreme Court actions and jury trials. A locally elected mining board replaced the Californian miners' meetings, drafting bylaws which governed behavior. Unlike the American institution they replaced, however, the decisions of the mining board could be overturned by the assistant gold commissioner, who also possessed the power to dissolve the board at his pleasure. Despite the early intrusion of this formal regulatory institution into the goldfields, British Columbia's miners retained a sense of themselves and their enterprises as distinct and crucial to the development of the colony. Despite their impermanent character, Gold Rush communities were localistic, regardless, paradoxically, of their location. Miners were particularly interested in the administration of the law, watching mining court decisions with an eye to their own fortunes. Though the law and courts brought British Columbia's diverse and far-flung miners together in a common process of dispute settlement, they also were the cause of much division, for they resolved differences by creating other ones. The law defined plaintiffs and defendants, assessed guilt and innocence, and ultimately, in the eyes of those involved, determined right and wrong. The potential for conflict was thus inherent in the process of dispute settlement. As will be seen, different concepts of law stood in bold relief against this structured background of formal dispute resolution. British Columbians understood and measured their laws with a standard that was rooted in a particular geographic, social, and cultural milieu, and that was not always shared by those charged with its administration. Conflicting understandings of what constituted law underlay the disputes which culminated in the Grouse Creek War, 1867, and which form the focus of the following narrative. The three cases that lay at the center of the controversy over the colony's judicial administration were all disputes over the ownership of mining claims. Each is rather unremarkable in terms of the issues of fact involved, which consisted of the recording and re-recording of claims and the placement of stakes. Once the cases were appealed to the Supreme Court, however, the issue of fact in these cases became secondary to Supreme Court Judge Matthew Bailey Begbie's actions. The judge's behavior in the three cases and public reaction to them neatly illustrate the problem associated with administering law in British Columbia and adumbrate the limits of formal institutional dispute settlement. The first of these, launched in 1865, pitted the Borealis Company against the Watson Company. After the assistant gold commissioner's decision awarding a disputed claim to the Watson Company was upheld by Begbie, the Borealis Company took the case to the Court of Chancery. There, sitting this time as Chancery Court Judge, Begbie reversed his earlier decision and awarded the disputed ground to the Borealis Company. By all accounts, the mining community of the Cariboo was incredulous, and the colony's three main opposition newspapers wasted no time in adding their voices to the growing cries of indignation over Begbie's ruling emanating from the goldfields. Most distressing to British Columbians was the use of the Chancery Court as a court of appeal, a process that was not only expensive and protracted, but was also capricious because decisions appeared to be unfettered by any reference to statute law. Quote, "The late decision in the Borealis and Watson case strikes me as being the most flagrant and arbitrary sketches of power that has ever been committed by an individual occupying the position of judge," close quote, wrote Miner to the Cariboo Sentinel in 1866. Continuing, "We have mining laws containing explicit provisions as to the manner in which claims should be taken up and held, but at the same time that any parties having enough money to stand the costs of a chancery suit may omit to comply with these provisions and set the law at defiance, it tends to create a feeling of insecurity as the value of every title. No man is secure if he strikes a good claim, as after strictly complying with the law which he supposed to be protection and spending his last dollar in prospecting, he may find when he thinks he has reached the long-hoped-for goal of his ambition that some more favored individual had intended in taking up the same ground long previously but had neglected, staking it off or recording it, a grave error certainly, but one which can be expiated by filing a bill in equity, making a score or two of affidavits, and paying his own costs in a chancery suit. And this is what is called equity." Close quote. Less measured was the commentary of the Victoria-based British colonist, which contended that the endless round of litigation in British Columbia's mining districts was, quote, ruining claim holders, shutting up the country's wealth, and causing disasters in communities hundreds of miles away from the scene of the dispute, close quote. Quote, the risks of mining are a mere bagatelle, the newspaper concluded. It is the risks of Begbie's Chancery Court that terrify the miner, close quote. Public indignation over Begbie's actions in the Borealis case scarcely subsided when his handling of another mining dispute again drew the attention and the wrath of British Columbians. After issuing an injunction ordering the Davis Company to cease work on disputed ground, Begbie discovered that the Supreme Court seals necessary to validate the injunction were unavailable. Detained, with the rest of his luggage, on a wagon that had broken down en route to Bridge Creek. Undeterred, the judge sent a messenger to Richfield with the injunction and orders for William Cox, the stipendiary magistrate and assistant gold commissioner there, to attach seals to the injunction in his capacity as deputy registrar of the Supreme Court. Cox, whose decision Begbie had overturned in issuing the injunction, declined to act as ordered, claiming that while he entertained high respect for Mr. Begbie as Mr. Begbie and also as Supreme Court judge, he held no commission as deputy registrar. Moreover, continued the magistrate, finding now that it has attempted to drag me into this disagreeable quarrel and act contrary to my own conscience, I would, if I actually did hold a commission as deputy registrar of the Supreme Court, resign the post at once. Close quote. Although delayed by Cox's decisive stand, Aurora v. Davis came to trial before Matthew Bailey Begbie and a special jury on the 18th of June. After deliberating until midnight, the jury awarded half of the disputed ground to each side because, quote, the Aurora and Davis companies have expended both time and money on said ground in dispute, close quote. According to the Sentinel, the jury's decision met with the general approval of the entire mining community, quote, there is probably no instance on record where trial by jury has been so fully appreciated. We are convinced that there is not a single miner on the creek that would not gladly submit his grievances to the decision of seven disinterested fellow citizens and thus avoid the expensive and vexatious proceedings in Chancery. Close quote. Despite the satisfaction with the jury's verdict evinced by the Sentinel, Begbie insisted that a decision by his court, quote, would not end the litigation, and the expense of actions in one or two other branches of this court would be heavy on both parties, close quote. Instead of accepting the jury's verdict, the judge suggested, quote, that the whole matter be referred to me, not in my capacity as judge, but as an arbiter and friend, and that whatever decision I may arrive at will be final and absolute, close quote. The two sides agreed, and the following day, the 19th of June, Begbie rendered his decision to an anxious courtroom. Perhaps hoping to forestall any criticism, the judge made it a point to downplay the irregularity of his actions and to praise the jury as an institution. I have always had every reason to be satisfied with the findings of juries during the whole period of my own official experience in this colony, Begbie remarked, but if a jury finds a verdict contrary to the evidence, resulting from ignorance, fear, or any other cause, it is the judge's privilege to set aside their verdict. Noting that, when men go to jump ground, they do not see their enemies' stakes, Begbie ruled against the Davis Company and awarded all of the disputed ground to the appellant. Reaction was immediate. 500 or 600 miners and residents of Caribou gathered in front of the Richfield courthouse on a rainy Saturday night, 6 days after Begbie's decision to discuss the administration of the colony's mining laws. Amid a great many speeches lasting well into the night, the participants passed 3 resolutions. Resolved, that in the opinion of this meeting, the administration of the mining laws by Mr. Justice Begbie in the Supreme Court is partial, dictatorial, and arbitrary in setting aside the verdict of juries and calculated to create a feeling of distrust in those who have to seek redress through a court of justice. Resolved, that the meeting pledges itself to support the government in carrying out the laws in their integrity and beg for an impartial administration of justice. To this end, we desire the establishment of a court of appeal, or the immediate removal of Judge Begbie, whose acts in setting aside the law has destroyed confidence and is driving labor, capital, and enterprise out of the colony. Resolved, that a committee of 2 persons be appointed to wait upon His Excellency the Administrator of the Government, Arthur Birch, with the foregoing resolutions, and earnestly impress upon him the immediate necessity of carrying out the wishes of the people. With 3 cheers for Judge Cox, the British colonist, the Caribou Sentinel, and the Queen, in that order, and 3 groans for Judge Begbie, the meeting adjourned. As a result of the mounting public pressure for reform, the colonial government amended the Gold Fields Act in April 1867, limiting appeals from the mining court to questions of law only. For all intents and purposes, this amendment made the decision to the Assistant Gold Commissioner final, something which bothered the colonial government greatly. This change was made against the general feeling of the Legislative Council at the insistence of the members nominated for the mining districts, and especially the urgent representation of the Mining Board of Caribou, Attorney General Creese wrote. However, experience shows the power of appeal to be a safety valve for the preservation of the peace in the mining districts of the colony. Close quote. These were prophetic words, but for the next 2 months at least, all was quiet in Caribou. The Borealis versus Watson and Aurora versus Davis cases set the stage for the final and, according to one magistrate, most humiliating part of this mining trilogy, the Grouse Creek War. Having found chancery and arbitration wanting, and his government colleagues sensitive to public pressure, in 1867 Matthew Bailey Begbie found only one option remaining, to adhere to the newly amended Gold Fields Act and refuse to hear appeals from the mining courts. This course was not successful in restoring British Columbians' faith in the administration of the law. The fault was not Begbie's, however. A less outspoken Supreme Court judge might have succeeded in blunting the sharpest barbs, but no one could have bridged the gulf between the different meanings of law created by the colony's geography. In late April 1864, the Grouse Creek Bedrock Flume Company, a Victoria-based joint stock company, applied to Peter O'Reilly, Richfield's assistant gold commissioner, for the rights to a certain portion of land on Grouse Creek. O'Reilly granted the company title for 10 years, provided that they fulfilled the usual conditions of occupation, licensing, and recording of the claim as outlined in the Gold Fields Act. During 1864 and all of 1865, the Flumites, as they came to be known, developed their claim, investing $20,000 to $30,000. But in late 1866, the company ran out of money, and their claim was left unoccupied from September to November. During this time, on the 8th of October, the Canadian Company, a locally based association of free miners, entered the Flume Company's claim, and finding it apparently abandoned, applied for rights to it. Warner Spaulding, who had replaced Peter O'Reilly as interim assistant gold commissioner, duly recorded the ground in the Canadian Company's name. At the beginning of the next mining season, in March, the Flumites renegotiated their lease to the Grouse Creek claim with the Crown, managing to extricate themselves from all previous conditions regulating their occupation of the ground. Inexplicitly, Spaulding, who had just 6 months earlier granted the same piece of land to the Canadian Company, presided over this renegotiation on behalf of the Crown. It was only a matter of weeks before the two companies clashed, and the dispute was taken to the district's mining court, again to be heard before Spaulding. There, Spaulding ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, and ordered the Canadians off the disputed ground. The Canadians gave notice of appeal, but obeyed the commissioner's order. Though the Canadians left quietly, they were back on Grouse Creek in a month. At the end of May, Anthony Melladay and 3 other Canadian Company members commenced work on the Grouse Creek Flume Company's claim. This time, however, the Flumites took their complaint to the magistrate's court, laying criminal charges of trespass against the Canadians. The foreman, Melladay, received the heaviest sentence, 1 month's imprisonment. The others were sentenced to 7 and 14 days. Noting that the earlier injunction served on the Canadian Company by Spaulding had been, quote, given to their foreman in an oral and extrajudicial manner and not in the form of an order of court. Close quote. The Caribou Sentinel contended that the Canadians had been operating under a misconception and that the punishment meted out was rather severe. At the beginning of July, Begbie informed the two companies that he would not, in keeping with the newly amended Gold Fields Act, hear the appeal. Though he underscored his opposition to the new act, the judge told the appellants that he was not willing to drive a coach and four through this clause just because I conjecture that it may prove mischievous or work hardship. Close quote. Undeterred, the Canadians regrouped, and now 30 or 40 strong, they again returned to Grouse Creek. Three constables and one surveyor were dispatched to eject the Canadians, but they were prevented from doing so when the company's men surrounded them, quote, without showing any hostile disposition or making any threats of violence, but simply claiming that, as they all acted as one man, if any one was liable to arrest, they all were, close quote. The constables left. Local sentiment seemed to be very much on the side of the Canadians, particularly in light of Begbie's refusal to hear their appeal, a situation that was doubly ironic, given that local sentiment, and notably the pressure of the Canadian company's principals, John McLaren and Cornelius Booth, had led to the 1867 amendment. Writing on behalf of the members of the Canadian company, Booth insisted they were not, quote, acting in opposition to the law of the land, close quote. Since they could not appeal, they were more than willing to force a new case. Quote, since the Supreme Court sat, they have made the most strenuous efforts to bring their case into court, not with a view of setting aside, but carrying out the decision of Commissioner Spaulding. Their case would not be heard at any time, and any action they have taken since is simply with the object of coming into court in such a matter that the rights they contend for may be contested on the real merits of the case, supported by evidence which is, I opine, the spirit of British law. Close quote. Booth told the same thing to a public meeting of 500 people gathered to hear, quote, a truthful and full statement of the grievances and position of the Canadian company. Close quote. The sympathetic crowd passed a resolution recording their sympathy with the Canadians and their commitment to aid the company by all lawful means to obtain their rights. The goodwill manifested toward the Canadians made itself apparent the next day, when the district's magistrate proceeded to Grouse Creek, backed this time by 25 or 30 of the most prominent businessmen and respectable citizens of the town, who had answered court summons to act as special constables. Once there, the, quote, posse comitatus exchanged the most friendly greetings with the Canadians and the nearly 400 eager onlookers who had, quote, splashed through mud and mire, knee-deep, in haste to reach the rendezvous, close quote. All settled in for a long and what must have been anticlimactic afternoon of negotiation by letter between the two companies. In the end, with no hope of settlement, the magistrate read a writ of injunction to the Canadian company and asked them to leave the claim. Quote, a unanimous no was returned, whereupon Mr. Ball, along with his constables, left Williams Creek and the crowd dispersed. Close quote. The magistrate immediately telegraphed the governor, requesting that a detachment of Marines be sent to assist him. The Royal Navy refused to intervene, and Seymour, quote, at very considerable inconvenience to myself, proceeded to Caribou. Close quote. It was this stalemate that greeted the governor when he arrived in Richfield a few weeks later, on the 7th of August. Seymour, along with the rest of the colony, had been treated to a series of alarmist reports of mob law on Williams Creek from the British colonist and the British Columbian, and no doubt expected the worst. Quote, in our most important gold field, the arm of justice hangs powerlessly by her side, while a company of men, under the most hollow and hypocritical professions of a desire to respect the law, are wantonly and openly trampling it underfoot, close quote, screamed the Columbian. Quote, it is simply a question of British law versus Lynch law, with reference to Governor Seymour's visit. To go to the scene of strife unarmed with a force to compel submission will simply to be to toy with outlawry while the coveted treasure is being grabbed up. Close quote. Calling for the imposition of martial law, the colonists noted that, quote, by offering armed resistance to the mandate of a court, the Canadians were criminals, who went into court determined to obey the law if it was with them, and to break it if it was against them. Close quote. The Caribou Sentinel took issue with its competitors' treatment of the Grouse Creek War. Victorians, the Sentinel speculated, no doubt wrought up to the highest pitch of excitement by the graphic descriptions of the warlike attitude of the Canadians, would be surprised if they were here. Close quote. Continuing, Canadians and Flumites may be seen daily in the streets of Barkerville, habited in the usual miner's garb, saluting each other without the slightest appearance of hostility. Close quote. The Sentinel's attempts to emphasize the peacefulness of the Caribou were not aided by the events which followed, however. A few days after Governor Seymour's arrival, the Canadian company strode into Richfield, not, noted one anonymous writer, in obedience to any order or summons, but at the suggestion of their leader, Cornelius Booth. Though Booth, the Talleyrand of the band, assured his compatriots they would not be arrested, 7 of their number were. Conveyed immediately to the courthouse, the 7 received 3-month sentences for resisting arrest, stemming from Magistrate Ball's earlier attempt to eject the Canadians from Grouse Creek. However, with the exception of one man, all refused to go to jail. Instead, they, quote, warned the constables not to touch any of them and abused and blackguarded the commissioner on the bench, close quote. The 7 told the court that if they had treated the commissioner to more champagne, etc., they would have won their case. Ball left the courtroom, and the governor requested a parley with Booth. After extracting a promise from Seymour to commute the sentences to 48 hours imprisonment, Booth persuaded his comrades to walk towards the jail, promising them that they would not be confined 3 days. This concession to the form of law was continued once the redoubtable Canadians arrived at the Richfield jail. There, wrote Crimea, they would not allow the doors of the jail to be locked upon them, and they had free access to all the courthouse grounds during the term of their imprisonment. By all accounts, their experience of prison life must have been very agreeable, for their sympathizers supplied them bountifully with grog, what with games and songs, interspersed occasionally with a derisive hoot of the officials. They were the jolliest convicts ever seen. Close quote. When Seymour left Richfield, he left behind conflicting impressions of what he accomplished. The Canadian company believed they had secured a promise for a new trial, while the colonist and the Columbian were convinced that Seymour had merely offered the services of Joseph Trutch, the chief commissioner of lands and works, as arbiter. Added to this confusion was yet another round of vitriolic newspaper reports from Victoria condemning the governor's actions, claiming that Governor Seymour's negotiation legitimized the actions of the Canadian mob. The colonists predicted an end to the, quote, security of life and property in the country, close quote. The Canadians rejected arbitration, insisting that they would, quote, accept nothing less than the law allows them, quote, a new trial. Less lofty were Cornelius Booth's sentiments about Trutch's arbitration. It appears to me passing strange, he wrote, that a case which has already, through the blundering of incompetent or possibly interested officials, assumed an unpleasant and dangerous magnitude, should be proposed to be submitted to the decision of an individual in whom the Canadian Company and the miners of Caribou in general have no more confidence as to his ability to understand and administer British law or British justice than they would have in the ability of a dancing dervish to understand and expound the Ten Commandments. Close quote. Seymour then appointed Joseph Needham, Vancouver Island's Supreme Court judge, as arbitrator. Needham arrived in Richfield in mid-September, prepared to try the Grouse Creek case, as well as other mining appeals, de novo. Noting that every court had the power to suspend its rules if, quote, any technicality arises that might tend to defeat the ends of justice, close quote, the judge began hearing evidence in the Canadian Company versus the Grouse Creek Flume Company on the 17th of September. After 2 weeks of testimony, Needham awarded all of the disputed ground to the Flumites. I cannot be blind to the fact that much public excitement has existed with regard to this case, he told the court, but I do hope and believe that all will acquiesce in the decision of this court. I can only say that it has been arrived at after anxious consideration and a simple desire to administer justice according to the law. I hope and firmly believe that armed alone with the authority of the law, a child may execute this judgment, and that no one here will be found whose wish is not to uphold and obey the judicial tribunals of this country, tribunals which have always been regarded by Englishmen as the fountain of justice and the bulwark of freedom. With this plea for peace, Needham ended one of the most protracted disputes in the colony's short history, and one which was noted for the bitterness engendered between island and mainland as much as for that between the rival mining factions. It also ended Begbie's stormy tenure as mining appeal court judge. After 1867, the tyrant judge heard few mining cases, leaving them to his less controversial colleagues. These three cases have been discussed before by David Williams, who called them causes to celebrate. They were certainly that, and more, for Aurora, Borealis, and Grouse Creek illustrate the difficulty of, in Joseph Needham's words, administering justice according to the law. The Supreme Court judge's distinction is an important one. While the Canadians and the Flumites were of one voice as to the ends of the law and the process of dispute resolution, they disagreed on how best to secure justice through the law. This was because of the variety of meaning the law in a colony as loosely organized as British Columbia. Their various definitions of the law revealed the importance of geography in determining its contours, as well as showing the limits of authority. Despite their differences, Flumites and Canadians used the same language of laissez-faire capitalism, which linked liberty to the security of property, to frame criticisms and to justify their actions. The New Westminster, Columbian, and the Victoria colonist contrasted British law with the Canadians' mob rule and predicted an end to, quote, that security of life and property in the country which has ever been our proud boast. Capital, finding its tenure insecure, will fly to countries where people are made to respect the laws and where possession of property rests upon a more stable and secure foundation. Close quote. At the same time, the Canadian Company, that mob of footpads and filibusters, used the very same language of law and property to predict the same ends if its demands were not met. There are three things the most despotic governments claim, Cornelius Booth told a crowd of 500 gathered at Fulton's saloon, namely the right to take property, liberty, and life. The first of these have already been taken from the Canadian Company, and there is but one step to the last. I repeat, these men do not wish to be looked upon as outlaws. They consider they have been unjustly shut out from having a hearing and would be perfectly satisfied in obtaining one, even if a decision was given against them. Close quote. The crowd agreed, as they had done in the wake of the Borealis versus Watson and the Aurora versus Davis cases, when they informed the colonial government that its laws and Begbie's administration of them were driving, quote, labor, capital, and enterprise out of the colony. To British Columbians on both sides of the Grouse Creek War, as well as the mining disputes that preceded it, just laws and legitimate authority were defined by their positive effect on economic development. Begbie's Chancery Court was viewed with contempt not only because of the laws of Chancery appeared capricious, but also, and perhaps more importantly, because of the costly delays associated with its proceedings. Jury trials could not guarantee satisfaction either, as Aurora versus Davis showed. Recourse to a jury trial was a poor alternative to chancery because verdicts could be set aside by an arbitrary judge. The tyranny of Begbie's court lay in its unpredictability and inefficiency, the two enemies of capitalist enterprise. Just as they used the same language and agreed on the ends that the law served, British Columbians on both sides of the Grouse Creek War recognized the same process of dispute resolution. The ends sought by those who opposed the government's administration were always to be achieved with the existing structures of formal dispute settlement. In Borealis versus Watson, Caribouites criticized the use of the Court of Chancery to resolve mining appeals because its ponderous proceedings were singularly unsuited to mining activity. But what did the miners propose as a solution? The establishment of a court of appeal. Similarly, in Aurora versus Davis, arbitration was rejected in favor of trial by jury. And in the Grouse Creek War, the Canadian company did not ask for public sanction of extra-legal action. In fact, it did not consider that it was acting in an illegal manner. But for, quote, nothing less than the law allows us, close quote, a full hearing of its case. Indeed, as David Williams noted, both Cornelius Booth and John McLaren visited Begbie in early July 1867 to ask for his intervention, surely an indication that they had not lost faith in the legal options available. Even after 7 company members were arrested in August, the Canadians still demanded that the, quote, tyrant judge or his island counterpart replace Joseph Trutch as arbitrator. Clearly, those who took issue with British Columbia's legal administration did not reject the structures of dispute resolution. Rather, it was to the official framework of English institutions that they looked for relief. In fact, the law might be seen as a kind of social cement holding colonists together. If Cariboo-ites agreed about the ends of the law and the institutional means of executing it, they took issue with what the law was and how to achieve justice through the law. British Columbians and other parts of the colony considered that a body of rules applied evenly and predictably ensured justice. Reflecting on the Borealis and Aurora cases, the colonists pointed to Begbie's lack of legal experience as the cause of the trouble. Unlike Judge Needham, the newspaper reported, Begbie had no legal experience to recommend him, and it is by no means a matter of surprise that his decisions, instead of partaking of that judicial clearness and point which are the universal characteristics of the decisions of English judges, should be generally rambling, disconnected, and irrelevant. Nevertheless, both the Sentinel and the Canadians dismissed the Chief Commissioner of Lands and Works, Joseph Trutch, as a suitable adjudicator for the same reasons and called for the intervention of the Supreme Court. Quote, he, Trutch, lacks the legal acumen which is necessary to unravel those knotted points of law that are inseparably involved in the settlement of the dispute in question. Quote, had either of the judges of the Supreme Court, or even a barrister of good standing, been selected as the arbitrators, no reasonable objection could have been urged against the arrangement. But to entrust the settlement of an important case like the present, which requires the exercise of no small amount of legal skill in the hands of a gentleman who has no pretensions to that knowledge, is simply preposterous. Close quote. Legal acumen was not necessarily specialized knowledge, however. The valued acumen was a knowledge of community standards and local circumstance. What Cariboo-ites wanted was law that was self-evident. In the wake of Aurora and Borealis, Cariboo-ites let it be known that common sense was the chief hallmark of just laws and just administration. The Cariboo Sentinel published a telling editorial emphasizing just this point by contrasting the conduct of Peter O'Reilly, the previous magistrate, with that of his predecessors and his successor, William Cox. Prior to O'Reilly's arrival, the mining court, quote, was virtually, if not nominally, a court of conscience, close quote. Quote, then the mining laws consisted of only a few proclamations issued from time to time by the governor, and the commissioner supplemented these with his own judgment. Since then, extensive mining laws have been passed and partially consolidated. It was not until the administration of Mr. O'Reilly that this court, by his false pretensions to legal ability, declared itself to be a court of equity or law, or both combined. The policy of Mr. Cox, on the other hand, was quite different. He made no pretensions to legal ability, yet his policy was at once most agreeable to the miners. He converted this court back once again almost wholly into a court of conscience, and presided in it with no little success. Close quote. Cox's success, the Sentinel concluded, was due to the fact he was guided by, quote, common sense rather than a smattering of law. Close quote. As the Sentinel's editorial revealed, common sense was an important yardstick of the law's legitimacy. Sociologists argue that common sense occupies an important place in human interaction. The strength and influence of common sense lies in its taken-for-granted nature. Common sense is common knowledge. It is a body of truths that does not need explanation, and probably cannot be explained, for it is instantly recognized as self-evident. According to sociologist Siegbert Lindenberg, common sense is, quote, a general baseline for human interaction, close quote. It is a frame of reference against which humans gauge events and understand the world as well as a court of appeal. Common sense, argue Van Holthun and Olson, quote, provided the basis of appeal to criticize and overthrow a more specialized and restrictive worldview, close quote. By appealing to a body of self-evident truths, critics attempt to show that the status quo is unnatural and illogical. But the concept could just as easily be used to buttress the existing order of things. Just as often, notes philosopher Herman Partet, use your common sense, behave commonsensically. These mean be conventional, be conservative. It is used to stop argument, fantasy, and originality, and it is often a deus ex machina, a rhetorical device to express power. Close quote. Given the ambiguous nature of common sense, literary critics argue that it is a powerful rhetorical device, part of the formal language of ideological dispute. Although common sense implied a commonality of experience that cut across political, social, and economic divisions, indeed, this is part of its strength. It was rooted in a cultural and social matrix particular to a time and place. Concepts of common sense were tied to particular locales. They were, as anthropologist Clifford Geertz contended, part of local knowledge. As such, the law is not a bounded set of norms, rules, and principles and values, but part of a distinctive manner of imagining the real. Thus, when the Caribouites appealed to common sense in criticizing the colonial legal administration, their meaning was clear only within their frame of reference. They wanted the law to be self-evident. However, what was common knowledge varied from place to place. Common sense dictated what was just, but because it was bounded by space and by local experience with the law, the concept had different meanings for different people. British Columbia's great distances, thin population, and poor systems of communication accentuated the localism of the colony's mining population. The mainland lacked an internal coherence that would have narrowed the variations in common sense. Its communities were uncoupled from each other, as well as the administrative centers of New Westminster and Victoria. In such a geographical context, a variety of concepts of law proliferated. The historian's task is to recreate that milieu so that others can appreciate it as commonsensical. The Caribou Sentinel's opposition of common sense and conscience on one hand, and law and equity on the other, is important. The Court of Equity was another name for a court of chancery, not the miner's favorite legal institution, as Borealis showed. Initially, cases tried by equity courts had been resolved by applying the, quote, standards of what seems naturally just or right, as contrasted with the application of a rule of law which might not provide for such circumstances or provide for what seems unreasonable, close quote. By the early 19th century, however, the principles of equity had become a body of settled law rather than a personal and arbitrary assessment of fairness. Ironically, though equitable jurisdiction evolved as a corrective to the inflexibility of the law, the Court of Chancery acquired a reputation as a morass of legal complexity and delay into which unwitting suitors could fall and never again gain a settlement. When Caribouites equated Peter O'Reilly's tenure as magistrate and assistant gold commissioner with a court of equity or law, and contrasted it with Cox's common sense, they revealed that they considered the two kinds of knowledge to be antithetical. The complexities of equity and statute law were far from self-evident truths. In fact, they were pretensions that caused unnecessary delays and thwarted justice. Cox's common sense cut through all of this. He circumvented legal technicalities by letting conscience guide his decisions. In the eyes of Caribouites, Cox's court of conscience was the surest route to justice. Yet courts of conscience were, in legal parlance, merely another name for courts of equity or chancery. Why was Cox's conscience, his ability to apply standards of what seems naturally just or right, superior to Begbie's? Why, in short, was the magistrate's common sense superior to that of the Supreme Court judge? Caribouites recognized the magistrate's decisions and actions as expressions of common sense because he was part of their community. Common sense was bounded by locale and rooted in specific constellations of social relations. Keith Wrightson shows that magistrates, constables, and jurymen were caught between different kinds of order, in which the execution of the law had to be balanced against the more tangible pressures of familiarity in the face-to-face communities of 17th-century England. 19th-century British Columbia demonstrates the same pattern. Because the colony's magistrates were a part of the communities they administered, they quickly became enmeshed in the politics of familiarity, a situation that both aided and limited their ability to execute the law. William Cox's knowledge of miners and mining won him the admiration and support of 490 of his neighbors who petitioned against his removal in 1866. Quote, "From the very long acquaintance we have had with Mr. Cox and the intimate knowledge he has acquired of mining and caribou, we consider him much better qualified for the office than any other gentleman in this colony," they wrote. Quote, "Mr. Cox's conduct has been such to us as to inspire the public with the utmost confidence in his integrity, while his judicial decisions have had the effect of checking litigation," close quote. These judicial decisions were often unconventional. On one occasion, the magistrate settled a mining court claim by making the opposing parties race from the steps of the Richfield courthouse to the disputed ground, winner take all. On another occasion, Cox swore in Chinese witnesses by decapitating a chicken instead of administering the usual and less spectacular oath. Cox's intimate knowledge consisted of a proper understanding of community morals, and it was this empathy that underlaid justice in the caribou. Community sentiment about what was right and wrong made it impossible to keep the Canadian company under lock and key. Henry Maynard Ball, whose misfortune it was to preside over the Grouse Creek dispute, failed because, quote, "he had but little experience in the mining districts," close quote. Familiarity also limited the ineffectiveness of enforcement. For the most part, policing was done by special constables sworn in from the local population as the need arose. In the Grouse Creek case, the special constables, who as men of capital and business presumably stood to lose from the unrest, were of no use in ejecting their neighbors, nor could the district's jailer incarcerate the Canadians. "The public feeling was rather in favor of the Canadians," complained Frederick Seymour. "At all events, no one would come forward to assist the government in an emergency." Despite the constraints of familiarity on the execution of the law, British Columbians would have it no other way. The interventions of outsiders in their affairs were considered despotic, even when that intervention was done by a figure as magisterial as a Supreme Court judge. In this context, juries became an important bridge between law and justice. "This community," reported the Richfield Grand Jury, "owing to its isolated position, the peculiarity of its interests, and especially its national origin, has a decided preference for local trial by jury and is extremely jealous of all its verdicts by its peers." The Caribou Sentinel was even more direct, asserting that, quote, "a man is wrong when almost every person in the community thinks and says he is wrong," close quote. When Begbie overturned the jury verdict in Aurora versus Davis, he not only breached what Caribouites perceived to be an established practice, he also burned the only bridge between the law as a set of overarching rules and as a set of socially and locally constructed norms. The judge's cavalier treatment of the jury in this and other cases led many colonists to conclude that Begbie did not consider them qualified to pass judgment on their peers. What these British Columbians objected to was not so much Begbie's failure to adhere to statute law and common law practice as the fact that he was not guided by the same self-evident truths as they were. He could not have been. The Supreme Court judge was outside their community. He resided in Victoria, visiting the colony's far-flung communities only once a year. His circuits were metaphors for his status as an outsider. Begbie's actions and decisions appeared arbitrary, particularly in a colony that lacked the social organization that would support the arbitrariness of paternal authority. because his decisions were not necessarily commonsensical, and because of the important role the law played in establishing some cohesion in the colony, Begbie's actions and decisions not only threatened the colonists' economic security, but also eroded one of the few bonds tying them together. Caribouites also considered the Grouse Creek Flume Company as an outsider. Not only were the Flumites based in Victoria, headed by one of the city's largest merchants, but they also represented big capital in a region where small, independent entrepreneurs were the norm. The Canadians styled themselves a company, but their Victoria opponents were the real thing. The Grouse Creek Flume Company was a joint stock venture, capitalized to the tune of $50,000. The Flumites were harbingers of a different kind of resource entrepreneur in British Columbia. By the late 1860s, most of the easily accessible surface gold in the Cariboo was gone. Continued success on the upper country creeks depended on a hydraulic process which required a substantial capital investment to construct the necessary flumes. Such an investment was beyond the means of most independent miners. Part of the support for the Canadians and the wrath directed at Begbie likely stemmed from an antipathy toward this form of large corporate enterprise that would eventually dominate resource exploitation and push out the smaller upper country operations. Conflicting concepts of law were central to the controversies surrounding the administration of British Columbia's mining laws in the colonial period. While recent writing in Canadian legal history has cast a critical eye on the law, revealing its normative nature, few studies deal with the variety of meaning the law could take on. As I have discussed, despite its detached nature, the law gained much of its meaning through the very local experiences people had with it. Foremost in placing meaning at the center of analysis is the work of anthropologist Clifford Geertz. Eschewing materialist and generalized explanations for behavior, Geertz concerned himself with recovering meaning, quote, from the native's point of view, close quote. A Geertzian perspective on theft, for instance, would involve contextualizing the act in a local frame of reference to understand what the act meant for the people involved, rather than linking it to more generalized phenomena like war and dearth. Whereas materialist explanations like the latter implicitly accept theft as an objective fact to be counted and cross-tabulated with socioeconomic data, Geertzian analysis, or thick description, treats theft, thief, and victim as essentially contestable categorizations and seeks to ground them in local circumstance. Both cultural historian of France Natalie Davis and English historian E.P. Thompson take this anthropological perspective in their work on the Charivari and rioting. Emphasizing the ritualistic aspect of violence, they root concepts of legality in community norms and see the violation of these norms as motivation for violent action. For both of these scholars, meaning is at the crux of understanding behavior. Many of those who dealt with formal law took the same approach. Focusing on local frames of reference, some English historians of the law explored the social context of crime. For them, legal categories were rife with significance. Forest gleaning and pilfering in the putting out industries, for instance, activities long sanctioned by custom, became criminalized as poaching and embezzlement. The criminalization and prosecution of behavior like this was interpreted as evidence of the growing centrality of private property in the politics and social relations of 18th century England. The Grouse Creek War and the events leading to it demonstrate the importance of geography in creating local frames of awareness that shape social meaning. The law Cariboites wanted had to be self-evident. It had to be commonsensical. Because common sense was local knowledge, however, its meaning was spatially limited. This localism was accentuated by the colony's geography, which effectively precluded the integration of the archipelago of small settlements that was British Columbia. Geographers and sociologists have recognized that space is deeply implicated in social life. Because human relations and the extension of authority are spatially as well as socially constructed, understanding what the law means involves more than contextualizing behavior in time. Distant places like the Cariboo were uncoupled from New Westminster and Victoria, the colony's centers of authority. In this spatial context, law and authority were rooted in specific and local constellations of social relations. For Cariboites, the law was more a collection of community norms than a set of hard and fast rules. Face-to-face relations, the politics of the personal and personality, loomed large in determining authority. Being recognized as an authority conveyed more power in these localized settings than being in authority by virtue of some extra community sanction. Although I have put local knowledge at the crux of understanding behavior, local frames of reference were not the only ones that influenced the meaning of law. On Grouse Creek, common sense may have gone a long way to shape what the law meant to British Columbians, but clearly the larger framework provided by the structure, institutions, and traditions of the common law itself also played an important role. Magistrate William Cox's decisions may have been commonsensical, but he and those who came before him still operated within a set of rules and procedures that at least nominally constrained action and provided a standard for measuring legality. As I discussed, British Columbians on both sides of the Grouse Creek War and the disputes that led to it never challenged the authority of the law and its institutions. Instead, they took issue with their administration and looked to the existing forms of law for redress. Perhaps more important in shaping the social meaning of the law than its forms were its traditions and the expectations they created. The rule of law promised freedom from the dictates of arbitrary sovereigns for all, no matter their condition. The idea of the rule of law became intimately tied to the security of life and property and became the keystone of English liberty. For British colonists, the law was an important source of unity, particularly in the years immediately following settlement. Though differences brought them before a magistrate, the British Columbians who resorted to the law were tied together in a common adversarial process that imposed a degree of structure, organization, and predictability on social relationships in a colony where such characteristics were rare commodities. More broadly, both for those directly involved in litigation and for those who perhaps afterward discussed and criticized its administration, the law was a link to and a symbol of a common, storied, and secure past that stood in marked contrast to the new and alien environment they found themselves in. The common law conferred citizenship to colonists whose sense of place had been eroded by the experience of migration. Much of the social meaning of the law, then, was provided by the forms and traditions of the law itself, forms and traditions which had their genesis outside the locale that has been the focus of my analysis. Although they were physically distant from the main centers of population, as well as from the rest of British North America, Cariboites were tied to another frame of reference through extensive webs of credit, the wider world of commercial capitalism. So dominant was economic activity in the collective experience of the colony that the language of laissez-faire infused British Columbians' discussion of the law and provided the standard with which they measured political authority. Begbie's actions and decisions provoked the reactions they did because they were the antithesis of what commercial capitalist enterprise demanded and defined as the criteria for legitimate action: efficiency, predictability, and standardization. Though British Columbians on both sides of the mining disputes demanded these characteristics of the law and conceived of it as an instrument of economic development, there was room for a diversity of opinion because of the spatial context in which the law was administered. Divergent concepts of law became apparent only when the localism of the colony was penetrated by the annual circuits of British Columbia's Supreme Court. Begbie and the Supreme Court represented a different level of law and a different level of social interaction. To Cariboites, the Supreme Court judge was an outsider. His reasoning and decisions were not self-evident because he operated in a world outside the community of local interaction. To be effective, Begbie and his fellow magistrates had to balance the demands of colonial administration with local sentiment. With these conflicting demands, quote, administering justice according to the law, close quote, was a difficult, and sometimes impossible, task. This was Gagin's delicate game, and it was one that would be played over and over again amid the Western Mountains.